Well, thank you all for coming out tonight. This is a really nice size audience with a lot of competing events going on. First off, let me thank Peter Berg and the library staff for hosting us this evening, along with the staff of the Red Cedar Review, who will be introducing all the readers. And congratulations once again to the student winners of this year's Creative Writing Awards contest. Just a brief announcement I need to make. On April 18th at 3 o'clock from 3 to 5 in Morrill Hall 213, Peg Boyers, who is an editor of Salamagundi magazine, will be speaking about editing and publishing. And then later at 7:30 p.m. on the same day, so that's April 18th, which is a Wednesday, she'll be reading from her new book in the green room of the Union, and it's free and open to the public, and we certainly invite any and all of you to both of those events. And I think at this point, I will turn the program over to Teal, the editor of the Red Cedar Review.
Hello, as Robin mentioned, I'm the managing editor of Red Cedar Review, and our new issue, volume 42, is actually out up here. If any of you are interested, I welcome you to take a look or take a copy for yourself. Everyone who is reading here tonight and all the Creative Writing Awards winners every year are considered for publication in Red Cedar Review, and actually several winners from last year's awards ceremony are published in this issue. And tonight we are going to start things off with Lauren Linsalata. Her piece, Open Frame, won second place for creative nonfiction. She is graduating in May with the tenuous honor of a creative writing degree. She plans to sleep in cardboard boxes for the rest of her life because of this. She also plans to skewer all of her professors, who she blames for encouraging her on this path, on an acknowledgments page in some piece of published work. And she says her efforts lay mostly in the realm of nonfiction and fiction. So could we please welcome Lauren?
Hi. The piece I'm reading is called Open Frame, and it's for Rocco. There is a photograph that does not exist. I know it in my memory. I saw it years ago. So the old Kodak stamped paper is square, not rectangular, and clad in a thick white border around the outside. It's in color, I remember that much, but the memory is dubious in its patchiness, a moth-eaten quilt of confusion. The photograph was, perhaps, tinged in mints and mosses, like a copper plate left to mold, with its dreary remains of whatever original blues and reds and blacks that were. They have faded under verdant uprising, a riot on the color scale on paper that looks like it could have been glossy at some point, but never was. This photograph that does not exist has a picture of a man who never was, dead before my first birthday, but brilliant. These are the two most common words his sons used to describe him, dead and brilliant. I have had the same meager stories offered to me of this man, and I devour them like scraps given to a wild dog. All they do is pique my hunger. They do not satiate. He defrauded the most popular translation of the Man of La Mancha, my uncle tells me, and he shows me the dictionary that was used to do the deed. A bulky, peeling object so immense it requires a podium, with tissue-thin pages and a copyright date from the 1800s. He had studied the language evolution of the Spanish Golden Age to earn his PhD, and discovered that the man who performed the so-called original translation of the novel could not possibly have performed the task. The vocabulary in the translation was anachronistic to the translator's lifespan. Words shaped and changed, and my grandfather knew that. But to my uncle, it is simply a book, a boring book to boot, and a moldering dictionary. His shirt is a faded memory, but something nags at me to call it plaid. No tie, buttoned up close to the neck. I do know that there were suspenders, and probably slacks of dark corduroy or khaki, but not denim, I'm sure of that, for I've been told that he disapproved of their informality. There are certain details that I can never verify that have lodged themselves as stubborn weeds in the cracked sidewalks of my brain. The only thing I do remember as concrete is the pipe. A pipe that killed him at 63, although it is hard to imagine him ever having been younger. The stem of it is clenched in his grizzled jaw. His face is hard in that way of a transplanted European's. Stories of his having come from Italy alone. My father tells me of how this boy of 9 found his way and learned a foreign tongue faster than any child of his age could hope. Of the photograph, I remember trees, or leaves at least. But despite the dreary garb and muted, faded setting, that brilliance is still there. in his eyes and his tolerant scowl, and the way he leans out of the frame just a little, an elbow on his knee, or perhaps a picnic table or a log. There's no way to check because the photograph that does not exist is tucked away. It still exists there, perhaps, wherever it hides now, slipped carelessly in with the hundreds of others like it, but even that is a fantasy, a hope that it has found itself a home, unsorted, lost, anonymous, in the back of my father's closet. The photograph of the grandfather I never knew is the only one of him that I have ever seen. He does not appear in my parents' wedding photos, or at my father's college graduation, or at my christening, though I have been told that he attended all of these events and more. My family is not one known for photographs. We do not have a withering aunt or a perky cousin known for pulling out a camera at events. When a camera is produced, most family members shuffle unobtrusively out of the frame. We do not have photographs of one another in our wallets or on our desks or hanging on our walls. There are no photo albums save from my infancy. It makes each photograph that much more precious, and for anyone having to have gone missing, a tragedy. My mother tells me of the first time she met him. Having come from a family of farmers, dinner conversation had circled desolately around crop rates, the trucking industry, and the weather for the first 2 decades of her life. Or worse, silence, the sound of chewing. She learned from him, gradually, how to discuss literature and politics around the red and white checkered tablecloth with watery crimson wine circles, stamping their way like footprints around the plates. Arms waving and napkins flying, each meal was a formal debate, a lecture, and a three-ring circus wrapped together. Every holiday, when my aunts begin their vulturing of this faded man, my mother sinks into disgust. She pulls me aside under the guise of helping to do the heaps of dishes produced by such large family meals and tells me stories while I dry the serving platters, of how intelligent he was, of what brand of cigar he preferred, of the book he was writing when he died, of how he told her he loved her more than his own daughters, who were too busy applying makeup and breaking curfew to bother with their boring father. Clearing out my grandmother's house after her death, I find letters. Letters that start in 1942 from his army training in Georgia, and I lose entire afternoons paging through the history of youth. There are thousands of them, enough to fill a battered, water-stained cardboard box that has lurked in a damp basement for half a century. There is a young man here who was part of an elite code-breaking team. The letters become more and more flavorless as World War II reaches its apex. The facts I know only from family confessions. Spy, my uncle tells me. Behind enemy lines, my father clarifies. But there are no clues of these mysteries on the insubstantial airmail paper, flimsy and delicate and decades old in my hands. I can imagine him going to a bar or a train station or a hotel and meeting with hastily sketched figures who, due to my lack of exposure to a variety of black and white films, all bear some resemblance to Peter Lorre. I cannot imagine what this man looked like in his youth, but it must have been enough to look like he fit in. Perhaps he was in Italy or Spain. He fed the information he could back to his superiors, and the movement of enemy troops were thwarted with great daring and little fanfare. The letters are out of order, so sometimes it is difficult to understand the progression of time. In some, he greets his children. I find responses from my toddler aunt, who has included pictures of herself and her mother holding hands. There are 8 years' worth of letters here that extend past the war. The postmarks change from army post boxes to Mexico City to Madrid. Slowly, there is a family born, but the letters continue. He is elsewhere, that nebulous elsewhere, the same as the photo that does not exist. And I imagine perhaps that they are now in the same place, the same elsewhere, that still involves cigarettes and a lazily rotating ceiling fan. He writes of hot summer nights and bands that play, but he never writes of himself. He writes, "I miss you," to his wife, but his handwriting is the impossible cursive scrawl of an academic, and it is here, in this determined absence, that he completes his PhD, the vast work and the research on the Don Quixote scandal. Why or when the photograph went from existing to not existing, I am uncertain. Perhaps it was simply never unpacked in the move from my childhood home in Missouri to our house in Michigan, or perhaps my father made a conscious decision to make the picture disappear. I have never asked him for fear that I may be right, that the photograph never existed, and that this man is more than the half fantasy I have created around him, that my father sprung full grown from his mother's aching skull. It is hard to reconcile the scattered puzzle pieces I have of this man and the gaping holes left in the image. My aunts tell me that I am so very like him. His love of literature has been passed through me. They show me ancient flaking books in Latin with marbled cover pages, first edition prints of Black Beauty and Pinocchio with the bindings ripped free. They deliver these things with relief, strangely grateful to be done with the reminder of a father who is too busy studying language to study his children. I take the books to be appraised, not that I would sell them, No thought could be further from my mind, but instead to discover their dates. The man who appraises the books does not look like my grandfather. He is reedy and insubstantial, and the glasses on his face threaten to eat away his features. The books, he tells me, date as early as 1608. He attempts to underplay the value and importance of 400-year-old books by giving me facts and figures about the Gutenberg press, and that these items are not rare, but I'm no longer even in the shop. I am elsewhere. I'm standing in my grandfather's shoes in a used bookstore. I am feeling the awe boil in the back of my throat as I stroke fingertips over flaking pages. Rarity is not what makes things valuable, I try to tell this man, and I feel the impossible vastness of the survival of the written word, for an instant so overwhelming that I must stifle the reflex to cry. I press the books against my ribs, just under my heart, and feel the wild pulse reflected across the generations in those pages. I wonder how he carried his books and how he cared for them. I wonder if he had an intricate system for organization, the alphabet, or by playing favorites, or on his own wandering chronology of when they were acquired. I do not wonder whether or not my speculations are foolish. In that instant, everything I have ever imagined about my grandfather is lanced into the sharp relief of truth. This, my father tells me, is called faith, gathering the chipped pieces of stories and memories to create something entirely new. The shambles of these memories, the professor, the father, the husband, none of it constructs grandfather in my mind. These pieces do not fit like wood soaked in water and warped year after year after year. They are the destroyed stone ruins he visits every summer in Italy. There are more letters from there, more cramped signatures and postscripts to his growing number of children. They are the splinters of wood he whittled as he edited his students' theses, spreading the addiction to the evolution of language. And what minds did he touch in Berkeley, in Columbus, in New York? And what would those minds spin free into the academic ether? They are the shards from shattered glasses he threw in heated debate, sisters cringing back from a father's furious temper, prepubescent brothers wrapping peas in napkins and hiding them in the secret spot under the wooden dining room table. He is the one person in my family I am most often compared to unanimously, and the one person in my family I have never met. In putting these pieces together, I am chasing a bigger windmill than the identity of my grandfather. I am standing in full Spanish armor to find the identity of myself. The photograph that does not exist is as corporeal as the man pictured in it. It drifts in and out of reality, a teasing reminder tucked in the shadows in the back of my brain, a warning and a creed and an omen all in one. This is the person my family tells me I am, and this is the man my family tells me, in ways other than words, I should not be. They have sketched their own impressions of him in solitary facts, in what they will proclaim as truth until their dying day, with no quarter to the decay of memory or a biased story. But because there is nothing I can see, I make my own image of a loving grandfather who has given me his adoration of knowledge, of literature, of the importance of art in life and discerning tastes. He has taught me in his absence more than those present can convey. When I was younger, when the photograph existed, in its cheap drugstore frame of slats of wood and industrial staples, I would pretend to know why the photograph was taken. I imagined it was snapped at a family picnic or a day in the park. Now I don't wonder about the constants of the photograph at all, the physical details, as they are unimportant or irrelevant. I just wonder why the photograph no longer exists and to where it's not gone. There is some part of me that is afraid to ask. I have ruled out asking my father what he might have done with the photo. Knowledge of a strained paternal bond between my father and his father, never fully explained, makes every venture into his memory a nerve-wracking navigation of what I may or may not ask. That they could have ended on bitter terms, a horror of every child in the face of the death of a parent, is more than likely. But despite that, my father, unlike his caustic sisters, will still spin tales of a man he adored. There are other venues I could go to for confirmation. My mother, for example, could easily help me hunt or help me discern whether the photograph and the memory of it is even of my grandfather at all. And this image I have of myself standing in front of the cupboards in the living room at the age of 6 or 7, studying this photo, is no more than mere fancy. Because of this, I no longer want to find the photo. It survives more efficiently and more effectively in my mind. It gives me ammunition against my vitriolic aunts and their daughters, my cousins, who have inherited their parents' disgust for a man they knew only slightly better than I. Now I fear that the photograph, if I could lay hands on it again, would show me something different. One failed memory would lead to more doubts. What else would be wrong about the assumptions I had created to form a man-like shape around this shadow? a pattern which would undoubtedly bloom outward, a spiral of disillusionment. Or perhaps my family's worst fears, my own secret hopes and wishes, would be realized, and I would look into the dusty frame and find my own face staring back.
Thank you, Lauren. Next, we'll have Karen O'Connor reading her piece, Keeper, which took first place in fiction. Karen is a senior at MSU majoring in English and psychology. She'll be graduating in May and plans to attend Emerson College for a master's in fine arts and creative writing or moving to Wyoming. She likes sushi, the color orange, her boyfriend Mike, and her two overweight cats.
Hi, this is called Keeper. My bicycle skidded over that dip where the paved road meets gravel, dust rising behind me. I touched the ground with one foot and kept going, pedaling, bumping across the pebbles, steadying the bike with the weight of my legs. They moved in toward the frame and back out to the sides, feet grazing the dirt like wingtips. Stones clinked in the spokes of my wheels, the gears rattled, metal against metal. My palms were sweaty from gripping the handlebars so tightly in the July heat. I wiped them one at a time down the front of my t-shirt, mint green cotton, the same color as the dollar bills folded in my pocket. Honey money, my mother called it, what we made selling beeswax and candles at the general store. I had used some of the cash to buy milk and butter. The sack of groceries hanging from one handlebar thumped into my right knee with each revolution of the pedal. I flew faster, trying to save the milk from curdling, the butter from melting into an oily puddle at the bottom of the bag. The road bent, slanted, became more of a ditch. My bike skipped over potholes like a flat stone across water. I could see the house just ahead. The mailbox, netted with morning glory and sweet peas, tilted a little into the road. The bike chain clicked, trying to keep up with the pedals. I smelled something like honey before I even saw the bee in front of me. It was inches from the bike tire, in the leaves of a fallen branch, lost maybe, making erratic circles with its body. I braked, rolled the pedals backward until the tires stopped spinning, but the bicycle kept gliding forward over the round stones of the road. It swerved over the branch with a crunch, the bee, the curb. I released the brakes, stretched my legs out to the sides again to keep the bike from tipping as I tumbled into a field of milkweed. The bicycle jolted to a stop, and I slid both feet into the dirt. I laid the bike on its side and ran back to the road. Crouching next to the snapped branch, I picked up a severed wing with a little bit of bee attached and held the glistening piece in my hand. I knew it was one of ours. My mother never wanted bees. She said that she hated their dull mosquito buzz and the way they tottered around the garden with no regard for where she stood. They ricocheted off her shoulders and rested on the brim of her straw hat without a please or thank you. They stung her sometimes, on the hands, when she poked her fingers behind flower petals and found a bee hiding there. She hated the bees. They must have reminded her of my father and the stacks of beekeeping texts he'd left nestled between her cookbooks. Every time she went to rip honeycomb from the hives, she still moved in the same way his bare hands had taught her to. Slow and smooth, steady, but with hesitation, waiting for the smoke to calm the bees before she pried the frames loose with her J-shaped tool. He had shown her how to ignore a few welts on her knuckles, to be nimble, purposeful, when she was pregnant with me. Raised to believe that a girl gets married if she's pregnant before she shows, my mother hurried to the secondhand store. She bought a wedding gown on the first day she felt morning sickness. The consignment shop had a dry skin smell, a smell that would have stuck around even after several washings. Musty, like cigarette smoke in the upholstery of a car. That smell made my mother nauseous as she sifted through a rack of lank wedding dresses, each sheathed in plastic, hems dusting the floor. She held her breath, clattering through hangers of eggshell, beige, yellow dresses, worn dresses, divorced dresses, stained and torn dresses, until between the folds she found lace, two sizes too large but white. White with original tags and a spare button still sewn to the inside of the sleeve. She unrolled dollar bills from her pocket, tips and allowance, letting coins spill onto the counter. How beautiful, the cashier said, rubbing her fingertips over the high neckline. My mother tried the dress on every morning for 3 days. Her fingers pulled the fabric taut across her stomach, and in the mirror she arched her back, hand on hip, trying to imagine a bulge at her angular waist. When her mother knocked on the bedroom door, or if she heard her little brother's footsteps in the hallway, my mother would unzip the dress and bundle it under her bed. She sat smiling in her nightgown, feet dangling over the duvet cover, when her little brother barged in, when her mother entered with a laundry basket. No one noticed the dust ruffles swing back into place. On the fourth day, she phoned my father. "I'm coming over," she said. "I need to talk to you." The call was nothing extraordinary for that summer. They had been dating, though not exclusively. My mother was out of high school, but just barely, and it showed through her sundress and sneakers, her two red lipstick, and the way she swiveled up the sidewalk like a marionette. When she arrived on his apartment stoop, with her hand hovering so close to her belly, my father knew immediately why she had come. He stepped onto the cement porch, his fat landlady smirking in the foyer behind him. The woman's eyebrows rose until they disappeared in the shadow of her blunt bangs. She tapped her foot against the tile floor, craning her neck to see my mother's young face. My father pulled the door shut, pressing my mother back down the steps. He bunched his chin-length hair at the nape of his neck, sighing. There was a hole in the armpit of his shirt, house paint stains on the chest. He hadn't shaved in weeks so that his beard grew in sparse hairs down his neck, bushy around his mouth. My mother touched the hairs, brushed her fingers against his chin like bare feet in the grass. He led her to the side of the building, just beneath the window of his rented room. They both leaned their backs against the brick, not looking at each other, but touching from elbow to shoulder. "Keep it," my father said. He picked up a flat stone, polished the surface with his thumb, and slipped it into his pocket. My mother was quiet. Her hands rubbed against her thighs. She felt the orange flowers of trumpet vine being crushed between her spine and the grainy wall, leaving stains on her sundress. A thick bumblebee staggered into her forehead, then hovered near her neck. "Keep the baby," my father repeated, turning to tuck one of the orange flowers behind her ear. My mother smiled, swiping a hand at the bee, stepping away from the wall. "Then you have to marry me," she said, facing him, setting her mouth into a serious line. My father brought his knuckles under his chin, watching my mother's nervous lip licking. He breathed in and out through his nose, then nodded. It was my father's uncle who owned this small cottage in the backyard of bee boxes. "We can stay there," my father must have said to my mother, "and take care of the bees." His uncle had tired of them, was sick of devoting half the year to harvesting the hives and the rest to testing for parasitic mites. So he gave the property over to my father, the milkweed-lined driveway, the kerosene lamppost, and the hives. "We'll get married in August," my mother said, hanging her dress on the back of the bedroom door. The house wasn't much, just a small bungalow where every time it rained, more of the white paint would peel off to reveal splintered wood siding. Green moss patched the roof and hung from the gutters. The sink had been removed from the kitchen, leaving a notch in the countertop, and a sleeper couch was arranged diagonally across the bedroom. The floorboards flexed, became elastic underfoot. They've always been that way. "What do we want with bees?" my mother mourned when she saw the bee boxes. They spread for a quarter of an acre under the pear and cherry trees, big old fruit trees, gnarled and too tall now for humans to harvest. "Beeswax," my father said. "Honey, we might be able to sell it." 20 paces from the house, he dumped a bucket of eggshells and cantaloupe rind onto the compost heap. "What a mess," my mother teased, but she knew that she was lucky to have him, bees or no bees, my father. "And when you start the vegetable garden, they'll pollinate that too," he said, pinching her nose between his fingers, playfully nudging her into his chest. But he never looked directly at her, always over her head, out a window. She just smiled into his Adam's apple, his chin resting in her hair. On weekends when he wasn't working, my father began to experiment with beekeeping. He always had a book opened on the kitchen counter, sentences underlined in pencil. In the morning, he would throw on a cream-colored Henley shirt and a pair of stiff jeans he had dyed white with bleach for the bees. Mosquito netting crisscrossed his face. My father followed the guidebook steps, smoking the bees into a torpor one box at a time, sliding the frames out to reveal mazes of comb. The tall grass itched my mother's ankles where she stood, pulling ferns from the lawn. When she rested, she would look to my father, taking in his every move. Sometimes she came closer, her body leaning like a right angle over the hives. She watched his bare hands work, his slow stomp through the weeds. Back in the kitchen, my father crushed the wax. He squeezed the sap out, tasting it with his fingers in his mouth. He filled jars with honey and convinced my mother of its sweetness. "I love the bees," she said, and she did. She loved to watch them skip from petal to petal on the black-eyed Susans and cone flowers that she had transplanted from the field into flower beds beneath the windows. She loved seeing the first tomato fill out, the cucumber stretch, the growth. In bed at night, when the bees had quieted, my mother would seek my father's hand under the blankets. "Let's get married in September," she said. She was almost 4 months along with me. The dress still fit. "I love you," my father answered, the same words every night, with a sticky palm on her skin. He said them until he could feel by the curve of her abdomen that I would stay anchored in her gut even after he broke his promise. After 6 months, he left my mother with her gown the color of picket fences. So she tended the bees, made candles, and sold honey, hiding my father's absence from her parents, who hardly noticed anything past the size of her stomach. She walked the aisles of honey boxes in her wedding dress, the gown billowing like the fumes from her smoker. The sides of the dress had to be split so that it fell over her belly like a tunic, loose and flapping without a belt. As the train grew heavy with dirt, and as her stomach grew heavy with me, she thought of my father. The sun coming through leaves left mottled shadows on her dress, dark splashes that rolled over her body as she walked. From a distance, from the road, she must have looked small floating among the boxes, but she felt enormous with her hands in the hives. Overripe fruit from the pear and cherry trees dropped to the ground, rotted slowly in the shade. Mashing under my mother's step, the fruit released a smell like Muscat wine. Bees landed on the sugary flesh, pausing, their bodies filled with nectar. They swirled around my mother with the wind, lifting and tangling in the hem of her gown, stinging her bare calves until her skin could not swell anymore. She wore her veil tucked into her collar and watched as bees' legs caught in the mesh tulle, felt the struggle of their wings against her cheek. They kicked, spilling pollen on the fabric until it turned yellow as attic newspapers, and I kicked to let her know I was still there. She thought about my father. In town, she saw him once, with a group of rowdy friends, a pack of men on the sidewalk whispering and yelling and patting each other on the backs. He hadn't grown up much, still the long hair, the smell of turpentine and dry grass. It had been a long time, he said, but didn't mention the bees. She laughed at his jokes and shook hands with his friends until her smile hurt. I was just a baby, saddling her hip, trying not to cry with all those strangers' hands rubbing my fat arms, with my father pressing me hard against his chest. "Will I be able to see her?" he must have asked. "We'll see," my mother said, and pulled away from him, lifting me out of his elbow nook. "You know where we live." She looked past his shoulder, tugging the baby blanket over my head. I couldn't see his face anymore. When my mother began to walk away, he leaned into her neck. "I'm glad you kept the baby," my father whispered in her ear. He squeezed my hand and let go. My mother nodded. "I kept the bees too," she said.
Next up will be Nicole Wen reading two pieces. One is called An Open Letter from Emily Dickinson to Billy Collins, and that was the first place winner in poetry. And the other one is called Cannery Row, which was the first place winner in creative nonfiction. Nicole is originally from a little town called Spring, Texas. Her favorite seasons are summer in Michigan and winter in Spring, Texas. She's a second-year junior in creative writing and professional writing, and not coincidentally, writing consumes most of her energies. When not writing, she enjoys web design, photography, green tea, and airports.
The first piece I'm going to read is my poem, An Open Letter from Emily Dickinson to Billy Collins, re A Missing Bonnet. Dear Mr. Collins, it has come to my attention that you may be in possession of a certain bonnet of mine. White cotton, white lace, white ribbon tied in a bow, which you undid with a light forward pull while I stood still on my wide board hardwood floor facing an open window. watching the lone carriage on the street below. A certain slant of light came across my dress, plain and simple and all white, puddled round my feet. You sighed in dashes, not I. With every hook unhooked, every pearl button undone, your hands trembled ever so slightly as you handled my whalebone corset, loosing the ties as I stood, afraid that my movement would disturb your concentration. My skin tingled from your touch, softly stroking light as air, the pale expanse of my arms, down to desire's perfect goal, your paradise, your ecstasy. But no nearer to your reach. I tensed, you hesitated. Then I sensed the ocean at my feet, my head immersed in the stars, and it became easy to yield to the bliss of new experience. All was silent when it was over, save the fly buzzing on the window pane. You groped your way to the door in the dark, the lamp put away, my bonnet clasped in tight fingers, feet quickly treading plank by plank, creaking across my soul. And next I'm going to read an excerpt from my nonfiction piece, Cannery Row. Almost obsessively, I count and recount the titles as I've written against the number of books on the shelf. I can take no chances. Travels with Charlie, Flowers for Algernon, Goodnight, Mr. Tom. I read the titles to myself as I record them one by one. I get to Cannery Row, one of several Steinbeck books on my shelf, though now it is shelved out of order. Putting down the notebook, I pick up Cannery Row and flip gently through the discolored pages. It, like most of my books, is from Half Price Books. Its white and red price sticker is still stuck to the upper right-hand corner of the front cover, $3.95. Every few pages, I find a word underlined, denoting something that I had to look up in the dictionary while reading. In my mind, I recall the story. The men that work in the canneries on that tiny Californian coast town, all of their personal battles. The most interesting character and the most memorable for me is Doc with all of his peculiar habits. I've had this book for a while, more than a year at least. My mom picked it out and gave it to me in a stack of 4 or 5 books, saying that she thought I would like them. Naturally, I wanted to please her, so I read them and told her that I loved all of them, especially Cannery Row. Inside the tattered front cover, she wrote a short inscription. The black ink formed tall loops and made connecting lines between the letters of my mother's half-script, half-print handwriting that I always admire. She wrote to me of her love for Steinbeck and her love for this novel, so I read it thinking that the meaning of this one would be as simple to appreciate as all the rest. But after my first read-through, my only impression of the book was, what's the point? The entire meaning of the book went completely over my head. I kept thinking about how pointless and boring the action was and how much I didn't like it at all. But I can't tell her about my dislike. I get the sneaking suspicion that it will just break her heart. So when she asks me about which parts are my favorite, I just keep dodging the question, but my excuses are running out. On my own, I keep picking it up, hoping that with each successive reading, it would become clearer to me why my mother liked this book so much. Secretly, it means the world to me to understand the book. I feel that if I'm not able to understand it, then I will somehow be failing my mother. It represents a pressure that I put on myself. My mother never really gave me any indication that if I didn't understand the books, that there would be any consequences at all. The fact that she thought to give me these books is enough in my mind to make me think that they are some task that would prove my worthiness as a daughter. It doesn't occur to me that maybe she just wants to share something that she values with me for the mere sake of sharing. And here I am about to toss the book into a box among many others where it can get lost. I know that if I misplace it during the move, she'll just take it as a matter of course that the book was a casualty of the process. I seriously think about hiding it in one of the other boxes, perhaps the one containing the stuffed animals that I feel I have outgrown. But I keep fingering the pages and the inscription on the inside cover. Guilty tears sting my eyes at the mere thought of getting rid of the book so that I can spare myself the potential disappointment that my mother will have in me when she finds out that I don't understand it. On the stairs, I hear more footsteps, my mother's this time. She comes into my room angrily at first upon seeing that I still haven't packed up the books. I don't bother to make myself look busy. The task at hand is more important than the packing. I look at my mother through my tear-stained eyes and hold out the used novel, saying simply, I don't understand it. I prepare my small frame for all kinds of disappointment and verbal wrath, and I am quite surprised when she just gives me a confused look. "What are you talking about?" she asks. Her expression is pure puzzlement, and I have no idea what to do. The thought crosses my mind that I could just make something up, pretend I hadn't been talking about Cannery Row. It's entirely possible that she forgot all about it, but recognition registers in her eyes as she looks at the book I'm holding out to her. "I thought you said you loved it," she said, her expression softening. Like usual, I fail to think quickly on my feet, despite all the possible stories running through my mind. I go into confessional mode and everything comes pouring out. I choke on my tears and my heaving chest prevents me from speaking in complete sentences. I am sure that she won't sympathize with me, that the disappointment that I initially expected is going to come out any minute, but I continue anyway. Up until this morning, my parents had relished my excitement and eagerness about moving. They kept reminding me of how mature I am being, and I deduce from their praise that this move more or less represents a rite of passage, the beginning of a new phase in my so far 10 years. After we move, I will no longer be a child with a large stuffed animal collection. I will be a young adult with an ever-growing collection of chapter books, ambitious novels even, and knickknacks on my shelves. But Cannery Row is a kink in my plan. I can only fake understanding the novel for so long, and then it and the bookshelves themselves will just become a mockery of my so-called maturity. With the new house comes this whole new set of expectations, ones that I doubt I can live up to. I try to relay all of this to my mother between my heavy sobs and nose blowing. I don't know if she fully comprehends the hugeness that not understanding the book means to me, but I can tell that she's not going to be upset. Finally, I cease my attempts at explanation and allow my mother to envelop me in her comforting arms. She holds my head to her chest, and my sobs subside and relax to match her steady breathing. As my moment of emotional crisis resolves itself, it occurs to me that perhaps this new phase does not have to bear the weight of so much expectation. There is too much comfort in my mother's arms for me to want to give it up for young adulthood. Cannery Row has remained with me all these years as something of a mile marker in my relationship with my mother. It is a small event in all the things we've been through together, but it sticks out in my mind nonetheless. Getting to the meaning of the book and understanding why my mother likes it so much are two different things entirely. Enjoying Steinbeck in Cannery Row is a difficult thing in itself. It's one thing to love his style and insight into the human condition, but why this novel as opposed to the more popular Grapes of Wrath or of Mice and Men is anyone's guess. My best guess is that it rings true with my mother's past, her family's working class and immigrant background, and their knowing, like the men on Cannery Row, the value of an honest day's work and the virtues of living day to day. The book and the new house as well, with its huge expanse of square footage and luxury, represent the two extremes in living that she has enjoyed since coming to the U.S. with her parents at the age of 15. Like many families where the children's experience and opportunities in life are drastically improved from the parents, my mother never lets me forget, and Cannery Row is just one of her many subtle reminders.
Hi, I'm Ryan Shannon, the nonfiction editor of the Red Cedar Review, and it's my pleasure tonight to introduce you to our third place winner in the category of poetry, Mr. Randall Malcolm. He's a very good friend of mine. He's originally from the Traverse City area, where he picks cherries alongside itinerant farm workers during the summer, and he lists only one hobby, burbot fishing. We actually went on study abroad together to Kenya, where we attended a goat sacrifice, were attacked by carnivorous pincer ants, and danced alongside the Maasai. We share an affinity for a spicy ginger beer called Stony Tangawizi, and it's my pleasure tonight to introduce you to Randall, who's going to read Murmurs.
This poem was inspired by a poem by Walt Whitman, "Out of the Cradle Endlessly Rocking," a specific line, "Oh, murmurs, you yourselves make me continue to sing, I know not why. Gulps of gravel towns, dark of burrows, and mouth of pine, wooden coffin booths. Mother's piano, lamplit sad, drowning rhythm. Her box of twilight, starch white and dusky, wardrobe of vestigial moons, the clothes of young women. Children in floating worlds of head lanterns and airy roads, the glowing bodies, crystal rock of bone, tall cloud bird land of red sun and deep cold fossils. Dam and silt churning, night boats and families drift, crayfish pools slumber. Murk of leaves shadow, bead-eyed surge of wobbling shade, tonight the weir hums, tonight is water and ripple of the kid wish, sandy river swill, tonight this whisper, tonight this tongue in my mouth, tonight mother's piano. Tonight is water and rows of poles and tackle flung into dimness, glimmer of the lures laughing under night's wideness, tonight cast together. Dogs on shore sleeping, June beetle night dam stirring, twitches of visions. See the strong city, but hear the constant churning, silt turning over, rolling with the young, the pink din and sparkle light, the sweating bodies. With my father's shirt and the blood of lunar will, we go out singing, mother's piano, the chords that wrap and spreading, the great black box song. Gulps of gravel towns, dark of burrows and mouth of pine, stones and graveyard grass. Thanks.
It is also my pleasure tonight to introduce our third place winner in the category of fiction, Mr. Michael Langdon. Michael Langdon is an English major specializing in creative writing. He was born and raised in Lansing, Michigan, but swears he will leave someday. He is constantly confused with the actor Michael Landon. And tonight, Michael will be reading Are You Being Called?
Are You Being Called? My mother says the only way to make me behave is to separate me from my brothers and sisters. My parents sit on either side of me here in our pew, the fifth row from the front in the middle right column. Mom and Dad sing the offertory hymn loud enough to cover for an entire congregation mouthing the words. My older brother, James, sits at the right hand of my father. My three sisters, Johanna, Amanda, and little Delilah, sit on the left of my mother. Three kids from my class are bringing up the gifts. There's Joe Kelly in a gray sport coat with the water. Miguel Martinez has the wine. I think he's wearing his school clothes, a white button-up shirt and navy pants. And Dinah Russo with the bread. Wearing her white Sunday dress, striding just ahead of the boys, she's holding her head up, looking steadily at Father Dominic. Here I am, Lord. Is it I, Lord? I have heard you calling in the night. My mom and dad bellow these words. I can't hear myself sing. Dinah gives the three golden dishes to the priest and turns back down the aisle. She looks in my direction. I think she sees me looking at her. I look at my hymnal. She joins her family just two rows from the front. Mr. Russo makes a big show of patting her on the head. There's a pretty big crowd in St. Thomas today. Of course, there are the old ladies, mostly widows, except Mrs. Bauer, who's still pushing Mr. Bauer around in a wheelchair after the stroke. Anyway, they're sitting where you can find them most days of the week, as close to the tabernacle as possible, and on the far right-hand side of the church. Mixed in with the gray hairs are this year's converts. There's a tall African man with glasses, a fat bald man who sings as loudly as my father and half as well, and four young women with Catholic fiancés. In 2 weeks, it will be Easter, and all these converts will be official Catholics. But today, they have to file out of the church before the bread and wine will become body and blood. And because it's Lent, and so close to Easter, there are a few families you never see filling out the back and sides of the church. Public school families. Public school kids with clip-on ties and wrinkled pants. Mothers in blood-red dresses with low necklines. Fathers in dark jeans. Lift up your hearts, Father Dominic says. We lift them up to the Lord, we all chant. As usual, the laymen, who seem to have a kid at every age, are seated just in front of us, with the Kaminskis in front of them, then Dinah and the other Russos, the Garcias, and in the first pew, a public school family, but regulars, the Stevensons. Father Dominic says, "Let us give thanks to the Lord." We chant, "It is right to give him thanks and praise." St. Thomas is sort of like a barn, not a big cross like the cathedral, but a big rectangular box with six columns of pews and a ceiling so high I get a little dizzy just looking at it. James, my brother, is making faces at the layman toddler. I can't keep track of their names. The toddler climbs on his family's pew and points and laughs at James. But when Mr. Layman abruptly slaps the small boy's hand and sets him back on the church floor, James is looking at the altar. We sing the holy, holy, holy song, and all over the church, kneelers clatter on the thin carpet. Everyone kneels, except the converts who exit at the rear of the church. I hate kneeling. My back aches, my knees hurt, and my penny loafers feel more tight than usual. I pull on my pant legs. It feels like my cuffs are at my knees. I meditate on the crucifix, thinking about Jesus' sacrifice, as Mrs. Schneider taught us. But now, something is happening. And how can it be happening now? Of all times, of all places, have I sinned? Should I go up for communion now? With this, everyone will see it. This is a visible sign of my unworthiness before God. But if I stay here in the pew when my family goes, everyone will wonder what I've done, why I can't go up. A mortal sin, they'll think. I've stolen something, or killed someone, or I worship the devil. Let us proclaim the mystery of faith, Father Dominic sings. I try to push it down without drawing attention to it. That hurts. Everyone sings, "Christ has died, Christ is risen, Christ will come again." And what if my mom sees, or one of my sisters sees and tells my mom? I pull it back up, I try to flatten it. Father Dominic thrusts the giant-sized host into the air. "Amen," everyone sings with the organ cue. I press myself against the pew in front of me. My father must think I'm praying extra hard because he's looking at me and smiling. My knuckles hurt from praying. I think I must be shaking. Father Dominic says, "Some sign of peace," and everybody gets up and starts shaking hands. My father shakes hands and gives out hugs like there's a prize for most signs of peace. Most people say, "Peace be with you," but he likes to embellish saying, "May the peace of God be with you and your whole family," or "Jesus' peace be with you." I'm usually trying to win the prize too, but today I only shake hands with Mom, Dad, James, Delilah, and a few laymans. I don't turn around for the DeLucas, and I can't look Johanna or Amanda in the eye. Everybody kneels again. We sing the Lamb of God. "This is the Lamb of God," Father Dominic says, "who takes away the sins of the world. Happy are those who are called to his supper. Lord, I'm not worthy to receive you, but only say the word, and I shall be healed," the congregation chants. It's time for communion. The hymn is "Pieces Flowing Like a River." The Stevensons get up. The Garcias get up. The Russos get up, and Dinah looks back. My face must be bright red. The Kaminskis, the Laymans, my family stands up. It's time for communion. I stand up. I face my father's back. I fold my hands below my waist. I am going to communion. And there is Dinah kneeling again in her Sunday dress. She's looking at the tabernacle. She looks immaculate in that lacy collar, her body perfectly stiff like an uppercase L. She turns and smirks at me as I pass. I look away. I stumble but catch myself on the side of her pew. I focus on the beige carpet until I reach the priest. Father Dominic holds up the host. "The body of Christ," he says. I don't say amen. Somehow, "and also with you," comes out of my mouth, and for a moment it seems I won't be receiving communion today. The host, the body of Christ, hangs in the air where Father Dominic holds it. He scowls at me but places the host into my palm anyway. I eat it, cross myself, and hurry past the wine and down the aisle just steps behind my father. I pass our pew and continue to the vestibule. I open the bathroom door, and inside is an old woman with her pants down. I always forget to knock. In the fifth grade, there isn't a lot of religion to learn. We had our first communion years ago, and confirmation isn't until high school. But it's Tuesday, and it's time for religion. Mrs. Schneider has been reviewing the seven sacraments for weeks. We're up to holy orders. By the window, the Bauer twins are looking at the parking lot in unison. Joe Kelly keeps trying to see what they're looking at, but he's too far from the window in the middle of the alphabet. Miguel is looking for something in his desk. Daniel Mancini might be sleeping, but it's hard to tell the way his head is propped on his enormous chest. Dinah, who has sat in front of me since kindergarten because she is a Russo and I am a Sensabaugh, has a question. "Yes, Dinah," Mrs. Schneider says. "Mrs. Schneider, why can't girls be priests? Men get to be monks and priests, but girls can only be nuns. It's not fair." She's been asking this one since the second grade, but Mrs. Schneider doesn't know that. "Well, Dinah, You know, the Pope, John Paul II, has asked that question frequently. And he prays to God and asks God if women should be ordained as priests. And the Pope says it's not God's will that they should be. My aunt says it's because the Pope hates women, Dinah says. The class erupts. Dinah, Mrs. Schneider shrieks, and the class is silent. Of course the Pope loves all of God's children. Mrs. Schneider doesn't know that Mrs. Russo, like my father, is a convert. Mrs. Russo's whole family is Episcopalian. Her maiden name is Moore. Anyway, Dinah, Mrs. Schneider continues, it's not up to the Pope. Men are called to the priesthood by God. Women are called to be nuns. Holy orders are sort of like a marriage with God, and only God can say who he's going to marry. It's Sunday again. Palm Sunday. St. Thomas is full. There are people here who haven't been since Christmas. Tim O'Reilly, who was in my class until the third grade, is here with his mother. His parents got divorced. Communion is approaching, and believe me, I'm concentrating. I've been praying to Mary and to Jesus all week. I've been praying to all the saints I can think of. I think it's working. I said, peace be with you, and hugged my father. We're kneeling again, and I've hardly noticed Dinah in that same dress with a bow in her hair. It's going to be okay. Father Dominic says, happy are those who are called to his supper. And Dinah turns around and looks right at me. Everyone says, Lord, I am not worthy to receive you, but only say the word and I shall be healed. I look up at the crucifix and it starts happening again. The organist starts up the communion hymn. There is no time to think. I'm going to communion. I can feel Dinah's eyes as I pass her family's pew, but I am praying in the direction of my feet. The body of Christ, Father Dominic says. For a moment, I stand there, almost numb, but I put out my hands and say, amen. I eat the host and retreat once again to the bathroom. I knock this time. It's empty. I lock the door and wash my hands carefully. I splash my face with cold water. I'm staring into the mirror. Everything is blurry. In the mirror is the Pope, John Paul II himself. But he's not in the mirror. He's on a poster on the door behind me. I turn to face him. The Pope is wearing his hat and holding his arms out, blessing a crowd somewhere. I ask him, this poster, the Pope, why is this happening to me? I'm good. I pray. I go to confession. I don't care about that girl. Below the Pope, I read these words. Are you being called to the priesthood? It's Easter. I really thought it was going to be okay. I went to confession this week. I told Father Dominic, I've been having impure thoughts. He didn't even look at me, and he said, say 7 Hail Marys, and go now in peace and love to serve the Lord. I was way ahead on Hail Marys. I said 70. And so it's Holy Week, and I went with my class to Mass on Holy Thursday and services on Good Friday. And last night, my family went to the Easter Vigil, 3 hours of feet washing and conversion and readings and candles. And it was okay. And I really thought it was going to be okay. But it's Easter today, Easter Sunday, and we're here at Mass, and the church is overflowing. The choir loft is full of non-singers. People were almost turned away. They're just about standing in the aisles. They're standing behind the rows of pews. It's so full that the Russos lost their pew to a bunch of strangers because they were only 5 minutes early. The Russos are sitting right in front of us, packed in with the laymans. Dinah is sitting right in front of me. Before the Mass, she told me, Happy Easter, smiling at me in her new white Easter dress. This dress fits her differently. The old one just seemed to hang on her. The offertory hymn, Be Not Afraid, plays. My father is in the choir loft blasting resurrection music from his trumpet with a brass quartet. Flowers cover the altar. Father Dominic wears white and gold as he stands at the foot of the altar waiting to receive the gifts. Our new converts proceed up the aisle following the tall African man whose newly baptized smile gleams for the entire congregation to see. Seeing the gold dishes holding the hosts, I remember I haven't eaten. I got up too late, and my mother wouldn't let me eat without more than an hour before communion. Dinah shifts her feet, and her dress shifts with her. Everyone is kneeling. I look at the tabernacle, at Jesus on the cross, at Mary. Mary's exposed and bleeding heart burns and shines. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, I whisper. Dinah turns and giggles. She heard me. Let us proclaim the mystery of faith, Father Dominic sings. With the Easter only half of the congregation a step behind, everyone sings, Christ has died, Christ is risen, Christ will come again. And it rises. I press hopelessly against the pew. Look not on our sins, Father Dominic says, but on the faith of your church, and grant us the peace and unity of your kingdom where you live forever and ever. The peace of the Lord be with you always, and also with you, chants the congregation, losing any semblance of unity. Let us offer each other some sign of peace, says Father Dominic. Dinah stands and straightens her dress. She turns right around to face me. She puts out her hand. I take it. Peace be with you, she says. I just shake her hand. She shakes my hand loose and gives me an odd look. Then she hugs Mr. and Mrs. Russo and her little brother, Sam. We're kneeling again when I hear Father Dominic say, happy are those who are called to his supper. The congregation stumbles this out. Lord, I am not worthy to receive you, but only say the word and I shall be healed, not knowing when to breathe or how fast to speak. Communion is mayhem. People are trying to go up the down aisles. Men in t-shirts are crossing themselves backwards. Dozens remain in their seats, having sinned too gravely to receive the Eucharist, forcing others to climb over and around them to get out of the pew. The Russos and laymen stand up for communion, and Dinah is walking. My family stands up for communion, and I feel dizzy watching Dinah walk up the aisle. And that's when I see Jesus coming down from the cross. I see Mary trying to hold him back, her heart just weeping blood. But Jesus is enraged, as if ejecting the money changers from the temples. And Jesus is lashing at us sinners with his tongue of swords. Jesus is bleeding from his side, and I am the Roman holding the spear. I am staggering up the aisle. I think, I have to become a priest. The next thing I know, I'm on the floor. I am on the floor and my head is in Dinah's lap. I am looking up into Dinah's eyes and she is crying. Her black hair is surrounded by light. You fell and hit your head on the pew, she says. Communion has stopped. Mass has stopped. There is no music. My father is standing over me holding his trumpet. My mother, the Eucharistic minister with her chalice, the laymans and Kaminskis, and Father Dominic are crowding around. They are all dark outlines surrounded by light. I look down. And they follow my eyes. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael. Next will be Jason Wirtz, the second place winner in poetry. He's been writing fiction for as long as he can remember, but has recently gravitated toward poetry because of Diane Wachowski's Advanced Poetry Workshop and the students in her classes who provide genuine and critical feedback, which is as much as any writer is allowed to ask for. His poetic influences range from Bukowski to Billy Collins. And he will be reading the poem, My Babysitter Takes Me to See Monet for the First Time.
I'm the Roman holding the spear. God, that is a great line. That's still just in my head. That's a double entendre, I believe. Yeah. My babysitter takes me to see Monet for the first time. At the museum, she has me stand guard. I am supposed to cough or whistle or do something if security is coming around. Slowly, she reaches out and touches it, where the paint lifts from the canvas like a rippling wave pulled upward by moonlight, down in the right-hand corner where he has signed his name, the script barely connecting the letters. Over lunch, she tells me, anyone can have a print, but I've actually touched him. Later that night, I know what she must have felt when, as she falls asleep waiting for the crunch of gravel and sweep of headlights, I press my palm against the blanket where I have calculated her left breast to lie beneath, gently rising toward my hand. The mercurial force of gravity on my side now as she takes a breath. Thank you.
Next, we'll have Lindsay Tig reading Collections of Lines, which took the second place in fiction. Lindsay is graduating from the English Creative Writing Program this May, and for the past 2 years has been the assistant editor of the Red Cedar Review and the head copy editor of the Offbeat. She currently works at the MSU Press as the issue production editor for Fourth Genre and as a subscriptions coordinator. Lindsay is also very interested in dance and has performed in the MSU student dance concerts upon graduation, She hopes to work in publishing.
Collections of lines. I'm a collector, Hannah tells me. I do dishes and she sits on the kitchen counter. She kicks the wooden cabinet doors with her feet as I scrub grease from a skillet. Gripping the counter with her little hands, Hannah leans close to me. I stare out of the kitchen window above the sink, but I feel her gaze, her little presence, and I can't lose myself in the repetition of the chore, the usual mechanic routine of it, the washing, the plates, the glasses, and bowls. Hannah has things to tell me. She needs me to listen. Life is important when you're 7. I forget that. I pause and face her. The faucet is still running, soap suds drop from my hands, and I hold them in front of me. I hold them out to her as if I have something more than suds to offer. What do you collect, I ask. Rocks, stamps, coins. I collect autographs, she tells me. She is matter of fact. I am a philographist. That's what we're called. She announces this with authority, and it seems as if for her, there is something at stake, that she knows she has begun becoming, wanting to be something. At odd moments, the 16 years between us evaporates, and there is only similarity. I work at West Day Credit Union as a teller. When I was little, I didn't think I would grow up and become a bank teller, but I remember thinking it must be fun, sending money flying through tubes. I wonder if that's how Hannah pictures me at my job, having fun. After work on Tuesdays, I pick up Hannah from ballet class and bring her to my apartment. She always scurries into my car, throws her pink dance bag into my back seat. How's my Bill Slingin' Lori, she always asks, just like Dad asked. I'm the best in the West, I say. I always say that because it is our joke now and we need it even though it is not funny. Sisters need jokes. Hannah enjoys our dinners, our sister nights, she calls them. She says I make better chicken fajitas than Mom, that they are her favorite. Lately, she has been coming over more often. This week, she's been here Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. My mother tells me how much it means to Hannah. She likes to grab my shoulder when she tells me this. The divorce, she tells me. It's so hard on Hannah. Things are allowed to be hard on Hannah. I'm a collector. That's what Dad would say when he met new schoolmates, parents, teachers, neighbors. I'm a map collector. I picture him in California, a state I've never seen, meeting people, and I wonder what he tells them, who he says he is. He never liked the terms dealer or expert. He wasn't comfortable with many terms except collector. He preferred the accumulation over the selling of his profession. Regardless, he was always more than he revealed. He was a great many things. My father surrounded himself by lines and landmarks, by ancient borders, mostly arbitrary and defunct. He was excited by symbols I didn't understand, keys, legends, scales. He loved holding a map in his hands and picturing the cartographer, his upper back curved over a draft board in belabored concentration. He loved to point things out to a fascinated audience, the agendas written in code. I was fascinated by his maps and by his wide eyes, by the way he would stamp his foot and pull off his glasses when he announced one of his shocking facts. Dad's favorite things to point out were towns that no longer existed. He would say to me, towns disappear, Lore, disappear. I remember asking, why? Borders can dissolve overnight, he would say with a sweeping gesture, battles and treaties, conflicts and compromises. And sometimes places are developed slowly, centuries pass and a present exists. Picture the river cutting slowly through the rock, deciding things. Just picture it, he would say. Why, I'd implore. Just picture it, he'd tell me. I don't know how much Hannah understands, how much she will remember about specific days. I don't really remember being 7. I remember my first day of 2nd grade. I remember wearing denim sneakers and watching a video about penguins. I remember single file, always single file after recess. What will Hannah remember? Will she remember last Thanksgiving? Will she see cranberries, the only food that made it to that table, the staring eyes of Cousin Kate, or me trying to shrug away kitchen voices that crescendo? This is not the time. I hate these lies. Even now, does she remember specific words? Do they become seared in memory, a brand marking a day, a landmark bringing fame to a town, denim sneakers that never leave you? Lies, hate, lies. They could resound in her, memories like tiny blows reverberating all the way through bones and staying as if trapped, because some memories indelibly remain, constantly sleeping, slowly bouncing, as if they are settling between vertebrae. I feel them in my back. I hold them in my shoulders and down the length of my spine. I almost want her to remember. Some things are shared by a family. Borders change, boundaries shift. I don't know what it is like watching your father leave, but Hannah does. It's not supposed to bother me. I was in my apartment all alone, unaware. I didn't see any packing and boxing, didn't hear a trunk slam closed or think California. Those things might have bothered me. I put the dishes away in the cabinet. Hannah has jumped off the counter and sauntered into the living room. I spend a long time drying the plates before stacking them. I probably place too much importance in these plates. They're lilac and square and they cost too much. Last fall, my mother took me shopping for housewares, and she filled my cart with towels, washcloths, soap dispensers. She encouraged me to buy matching plates, bowls, mugs. She said, now you're an adult. You will be more inclined to cook and entertain if you have a nice set of plates. These plates are the answer. These are the ones I had decided, reaching for the lilac set. Entertaining. It is so important to my mom. She fixates on doing things, what she believes she enjoys. If I do A, then B will happen, she thinks. Very cause and effect. If I go here, have this, do that, I will be happy. I'll have to be. It is getting later, and in an hour, I will take Hannah back home where our mother waits, watching TV alone. That is how she waits for people to return. Right now, Hannah is sitting on my couch with her back to me. Since there is no wall between the kitchen and living room, I can see the very top of her head, just visible over the back of the couch. She appears to be flipping through something, looking down. I hear pages turning. My hand rests on the counter, and I stare at that flash of blonde ponytail. I had heard of Hannah's philographist hobby. Mom had called to make sure I wasn't buying Hannah a laminator for Christmas. Apparently, Hannah believes laminating her growing collection of autographs is the key to preservation. She does not want any ink to bleed. She can already see her nascent collection yellowing from time. Apparently, Hannah told our mother she was going to ask me for the laminator. But don't worry, Mom said. They cost $125. I looked them up online. I will get this one, Lore. I wouldn't expect you to spend that much on Hannah. Anyway, my mother continued over the phone, I will be able to use it to laminate recipes. Last year, a man named E. Forbes Smiley III walked into the Beinecke Rare Book and Manuscript Library at Yale University, and he appeared to be a harmless scholar, a collector of maps, an expert, not a thief. But Smiley brought an X-Acto knife to the library that day, and instead of examining maps, examining lines and borders, he began cutting his own, began cutting 16th and 17th century maps out of historic atlases. I picture him cutting the maps out as if they were coupons, praising himself for a good clean tear, running his hand along the jagged edge. But I know he had to have been stealthier. He had to be quick but careful. A clean, rapid swipe of blade in that reading room with the calculated temperature, the best for preservation. This man was not my father, but my father knew him. Mother told me later that she had asked Dad if he knew Smiley's dishonesty. He said he didn't, and I suppose it isn't important whether Dad knew Smiley was stealing history, smuggling out in his coat. Sometimes a line is crossed. Betrayal takes many forms. He betrayed me, I can hear my mom say. Affair, I can hear my aunt mouth to the neighbors. I can't be sure that this is why my mom lives alone, why my dad lives in California. I don't know if A causes B like my mom does, or that scandal changes everything. But there's agenda in maps. There's money and power. All of a sudden, a country exists, a line is given importance, a wall is built in Berlin, a 38th parallel means something. This I know. Things change. The baby is born, the father leaves, a line disappears. The family tree branches, then branches again. I walk over to where Hannah is still sitting on the couch. One of my lilac bowls sits on the coffee table in front of her. It is filled with mints. I sit down next to her and watch her flip through her autograph collection. She shows me her organization and tells me her grand plans. She has the notebook tabbed and divided: family, friends, animals, famous people, imposters. So far, she has my autograph and Mom's autograph and family. She has her friend Caitlin and friends and a paw print of Caitlin's dog and animals. She has moved her music teacher from friends to famous people because she found out he used to do voiceovers for animated films. She says she plans to get loads of famous people to sign autographs when she goes to visit Dad in California. He will probably know lots of famous people by Christmas, she says. Probably, I say. Hannah pulls out a piece of practice notebook paper, the oversized kind they give out in elementary school for handwriting. She begins to write her name, painstakingly, using the autograph binder as a lap desk. She prints H-A-N-N-A-H. She hasn't learned cursive yet. She will perfect the art of signature later, the ownership and individual style of one's name. She will practice it, doodling during history class or math class, like I did. She will make her lines mean something. When she's done, I take her piece of paper and her binder, and I write my name below it. I print slowly, so it doesn't look like I am trying to impress her or show her up. I slide our names into the window pocket on the front of the binder and then begin flipping through her pages again. Borders change, boundaries shift. Lines can be stolen. People steal things from each other all the time. People keep things in binders. They preserve, they collect. They laminate their past alongside recipes. People are the ones trying to see meaning in the lines. Hannah stares at me as I look at her autographs. She takes the binder from me and slams it shut. I wish Dad were here, she says. She picks up my bowl of mints, my lilac bowl, and she looks at me quickly before hurling it against the wall. It shatters and the mints fall to the carpet. She just looks at me, waiting. Since she was born, she's had to take from me mints with me, and I can't mind, don't mind. Things shatter and 16 years evaporate. Similarity is even more than a line, than a tie. It can't be coded in a legend and drawn to a scale, and sisters need it the way they need jokes. They need to feel it the way I feel it in my back, down to my core, at the very base of something.
I apologize. Is Mr. Beechnaw here tonight? Jeff Beechnaw? Okay. Mr. Beechnaw, we did not secure your biography, but Mr. Beechnaw is the first place winner in the category of screenplay, and he will be reading now.
Multiple roles, but hopefully they'll get the idea. The screenplay is Hungry for You, and this will be in the middle of the script. Just to give you the brief synopsis, Ray is the owner of a clothing company called Clothes R Us, and his wife Karen is a kindergarten teacher who is also having an affair. Their daughter Jane is an outcast because, unlike the rest of society, she refuses to eat humans. But she has a new boyfriend, Kurt, and the son, Warren, is a struggling fourth grader. He has been told he's been recruited for an experiment, but in reality, he's been taken to a factory where failing students get fattened up to be eaten. Okay. And here, Evans living, and sorry, their last name is Evans. Ray Evans. Okay, into here, Evans living room, night. Jane walks through the room, passing in front of Ray.
Hey, honey, have you seen Warren today?
No, I haven't seen him.
Did your mother ever bring him home from school?
I don't think so.
Well, I better call Mrs. Richardson. Maybe he's over at Will's house.
Jane exits the room. Ray picks up the phone and dials.
Hi, Will. This is Mr. Evans. Is Warren over at your house? He what? Oh, my God.
Ray hangs up the phone. Interior at Kurt's house tonight. Kurt and Aaron are sitting on the couch watching TV. A cop show is on TV. A policeman is chasing after a criminal on foot. The cop catches the person and arrests him.
Now that's what I call fa.
Damn it, if you say that's fast food one more time, I'm going to kill you.
Oh, come on, man. It's funny.
Kurt looks sternly at Aaron.
Yeah, whatever. So, dude, what happened with that chick?
Kurt snaps out his angry spell.
She was just sitting in the corner at that party, and I just moseyed on over working my thing.
Yeah? Then what?
Well, like always, one thing led to another, and I'm banging her in my bedroom.
He's supposed to be like 17 years old.
You can't leave me hanging like this. Who'd you pick?
Jane Evans.
You didn't. You actually did it with that veggie bitch?
Hey, sure, she's kind of weird, but like I said, she wasn't that bad.
Well, at least it's a nice choice. You sure you still want to do it?
Yeah, I do. It won't be easy, though.
Interior Evans living room, night. Karen walks into the living room. Ray is sitting in the quiet room, staring at the turned-off television.
Sorry I'm late, honey. I had a lot of papers to go over.
It's okay. Listen, Warren's been taken away.
No. Oh, yeah, sorry. Karen gasps.
Gasp. No, that's too quick. They couldn't have.
I just found out earlier tonight. It really happened.
What are we going to do?
I don't know, honey. And on a lighter note, my business is falling apart. That damn Zabel is crushing Close R Us. Honey, if I ask you to do something, would you do it?
What?
Zabel's taking all of our good stock. I think some of our suppliers have gone over to Family Fashion. We're running low on clothing. How do I say this? I need you to fail some of your students so I can use them for business.
Right, that's horrible.
Oh, come on, Karen. You said there were monsters. Besides, we're going to need some money fast in order to get Warren back. Do you have any ideas?
Well, what am I supposed to do with them after I fail them? It's the children's factory that takes them away.
I'll come in pretending to be one of the guys, and I'll just take the kids away and use them for clothes. And when we're done, we can use their meat. Then we don't have to worry about money troubles for now.
Ray, I don't know. This just doesn't seem right.
Honey, we don't have any choices. Do it for Warren.
Exterior, open field, day. The sun shines on the open, grassy field. There are hundreds of flowers and dozens of butterflies. Warren stands in the center of all the beauty. He gleefully walks through the peaceful field. A group of turkeys appear and wander in front of Warren. They gobble wildly and transform into cooked turkeys. Gobble, 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 one of us, one of us. Gobble, 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 one of us, one of us. Warren runs away from the turkeys. A group of turkeys gather together and chase after Warren. Pat Benatar's Hell is for Children plays. Warren pants wildly, fleeing from the evil turkeys. Sweat pours down from his face. He reaches a giant, square, white metal building. There's a large open entrance in front of the building. Warren runs through the entrance. The turkeys are close behind him. Interior, metal building, continuous. A large glass door slides open, separating Warren from the turkeys. Out of breath, he sits down resting. He looks through the glass at the cooked turkeys. Out of breath, he goes to the back corner of the huge room and rests. The only source of light is the sunlight shining through the glass entrance. Alone in the dark, Warren breathes heavily. Hell is for Children still plays loudly. A red light suddenly fills the whole room. The room starts to get hot. Sweating, Warren rushes to the entrance and pounds on the glass door. The cooked turkeys peer through the door, looking at Warren. Gobble, 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 one of us, one of us. Exterior, open field, continuous. The camera zooms out, showing the entire building. The building is a giant oven. Interior metal building, continuous. Warren continues to pound on the glass door. The floor turns bright red.
No! I'm a writer, not an actor.
Interior, children factory, sleeping hall, night. Warren struggles in his bed sheets, pounding into the air, screaming. He is covered in sweat. He jolts up from the bed, letting out a gasp. He calms down and inspects the area. Warren is one of many children lying in the rows of beds on both sides of the room. All of the children are sleeping. Exterior, park, day. Jane and Kurt walk in the park together, holding hands. They pass by a couple sitting on a bench, a young adult and a pregnant woman. Jane breaks the silence during their peaceful walk.
Kurt, why did you walk over to me that night?
What do you mean?
Well, you've never talked to me before. You've never even looked at me. Why, with all the talkative and spirited girls that night, why did you come over to me?
Hey, it always starts somewhere. You're a nice girl. I just wanted to get to know you.
Even knowing that I'm that crazy veggie bitch?
What?
I know what people say about me. You don't need to hide it.
Hey, you're not crazy. Don't listen to those people. We're together now, aren't we? Shouldn't that be all that matters?
Kurt wraps his arm around Jane and they walk along the pond. Interior, mess hall, day. Warren sits at the table with a group of other kids. He looks down at his large plate filled with food.
They sure do feed us a lot of food, don't they?
Yeah, they do. It's great.
So, where are you from?
Bakersfield.
Oh, I know some people from there. Where did you go to school?
Who cares? School is stupid. It always makes me work so hard.
A stern lady dressed in white walks up to the table. She smacks the table with a stick.
Stop talking and eat.
Warren jumps for a moment. He gives her a confused look. The stern lady walks away.
I don't like it here. We gotta figure out what we're gonna do to get out of here.
Interior, kindergarten classroom, afternoon. All the children are playing quietly. Karen sits at her desk, looking over her notes. She drags her finger down the list of all the students' names, looking at each of their individual grades. They are all doing well in class. She looks up from her notes at the cheerful students. Closing her eyes, she drags her fingers down to the list again and stops on a name. She opens her eyes and looks at the name, Aaron Bender. Erin has multiple stars on and smiley faces next to her name. Karen looks up and finds Erin among the playing students. Erin has blonde pigtails, is dressed in red, holds a doll, and plays with other girls. They're all laughing together. Karen looks at the picture of Warren on her desk. She picks up the phone. Interior Ray's car, afternoon. Ray's dressed all in white, wearing a white hat. He looks over at Erin and smiles at her.
Where are we going?
Oh, it's a surprise.
Ray pulls up to the hospital parking lot. Interior hospital hallway, afternoon. Ray and Erin walk down the hallway. Ray stops at the hospital morgue entrance.
Now you wait right here. I'll be right back.
Ray opens the door and goes in. Erin sits down in a chair, brushing her doll's hair. Cut to interior hospital morgue, afternoon. Dr. Jackson leans over a corpse about to make an incision.
Hey, Doc.
Dr. Jackson, startled, cuts into the body unprepared. A spurt of blood splashes on Dr. Jackson in the face.
Damn it, Ray. Will you warn me when you'll do that?
Oh, sorry, Doc.
Dr. Jackson walks over to the sink.
Listen, I got a favor to ask you.
Yeah, I'm listening.
Dr. Jackson washes his bloody face off with a white towel. Interior hospital hallway, afternoon. Dr. Jackson, wearing a bloody apron, peeks out the door, looking at Erin. Interior hospital morgue, continuous.
Oh, Ray heard, but she's so alive.
Will you do it?
Dr. Jackson walks over to his cabinet.
I'm doing this because I love you, man.
Dr. Jackson grabs a needle and inserts a liquid into it.
Thanks, man. I owe you big time.
You're damn right you do.
Exterior, restaurant, evening. A large plastic chef stands at the entrance of the restaurant. His right hand is raised, holding a boy, but resting between two hamburger buns. Interior, big boy, evening. Karen and Al sit at the table. A waiter walks up to the two, chewing gum loudly. She wears an apron, has a apron, has a pencil, and behind his ear carries a notepad.
Hi, could I have the kids' menu?
Sure thing. The waiter gives Al the menu and refills Karen's drink.
Darling, I got you something.
Al pulls a small jewelry box from his pocket. He hands it to Karen.
It's a necklace.
Karen opens the box. Inside is a golden necklace. She opens the locket. Inside are two pictures of Al.
Oh, it's beautiful, Al. Thank you.
Al gets up from the table and puts the necklace on Karen. Al sits back down. Karen grabs his hand and kisses him.
This is so romantic.
The waiter walks up to the table. He chews his gum loudly. Are you ready to order?
Yes. I'll have the kitty burger.
And for you, miss?
I'll have the broiled scallops.
The waiter jots down the order and walks away. Karen is quiet.
Hey, what's wrong? Is it the necklace?
No, it's just my son, Warren, he got taken away to the factory.
Oh, that's always tough. But, you know, you'll get over it. These things happen all the time. You'll just have to accept it.
Karen gives a fake smile.
Thanks, Al.
Before our final reader tonight, I would like to make a quick announcement. We have named the editors for next year's Red Cedar Review. So if we could get a congratulations for Lindsay Sloan, who will be next year's managing editor, and Jill Kolongowski, who will be next year's assistant editor. Could you guys please stand up? Our final reader is Corey Cool, who took third place for creative nonfiction. He is 22 years old, an English and creative writing major from Jackson, Michigan. He is a senior currently working on his thesis with Marsha Aldrich. He keeps busy with classes as well as working as a bank teller part-time, which seems to keep finding its way into his writing. He is also a resident mentor in Wilson Hall. After graduating, he hopes to attend grad school where he can continue to study creative writing, most likely in the form of creative nonfiction. And Corey will be reading his piece, Another Day.
That last one makes me wish I had parts for all of you. Another day. Open your eyes. Shut off the alarm. Don't move too quickly. You are slightly hungover, and sudden movements cause the room to gyrate. Realize it looks like another four aspirin morning and dive in. Note how the water on your nightstand seems refreshing, even with floating dust particles. Today is Wednesday, a work day, the day before Thanksgiving, another day. Tonight after work, you will drive to the house in Jackson where you grew up, a trip that you could make in 35 minutes, but tonight you won't speed during the drive. Tonight you'll take the long way home, enjoying the road and not minding the delay of holiday traffic. Divert your eyes from the mirror while undressing. Ignore the fact that you no longer recognize your own body. Tell yourself, ribs are in this year, when looking at your protruding rib cage. Wash your face, attempt to piece together the evening before and why your hair smells like an ashtray. Breathe. Your roommate Matt began knocking on your door around 10 p.m. and continued to do so in 15-minute intervals until you answered an hour later. His eyes possessed a familiar glaze and his body swayed back and forth between the frame of the door. Stand in a trance while in the shower. Become hypnotized by the monotonous sound of the water as it cascades over your body and crashes against the linoleum. Realize you are going to be late for work when the hot water starts to turn. Get dressed, brush your teeth, forget breakfast. Tell yourself, perhaps it isn't the most important meal of the day. What are you doing tonight? Matt asked. Before you could shrug, he entered your room uninvited. He began rifling through your closet, looking for anything that might be deemed club attire. Having grown used to this, you didn't try to stop him. Matt works at a clothing store in the mall where he gets paid minimum wage to fold clothing and dance to techno remixes the store plays at near deafening volumes. He doesn't need the job, though. Unlike your parents, Matt's parents pay for everything. He says he works for the store discount, but you know it so he can hit on the fraternity guys who shop there. He claims he was born gay, but says he's fabulous by choice. Deep down, you secretly wish you were him. Drive to work half asleep because you're used to the road and the repetitive morning traffic. The only thing that catches your attention is the ambulance causing you to pull over 5 blocks east of North Washington Square, where you were supposed to be to work 5 minutes ago. Wonder who was in the passenger bay and how'd they get so lucky. You took a shot with Matt and his friends in your kitchen. Then, after a mixed drink that resembled poison, you took 2 more shots and the room started to cloud and spin. You didn't protest that perhaps Matt's friend was too drunk to drive to the bar. You just got in the car and buckled your seatbelt. At work, the downtown location, park your car on the ramp and walk 2 blocks to the bank. The manager doesn't recognize you when your face meets his on opposing sides of the front door, and even though you've worked for this branch multiple times, he tells you the bank doesn't open until 9 a.m. Wish you had a pair of gloves or a heavier coat while explaining to him who you are. Accept his apology once he lets you inside. Disregard the fact that he made you stand in the cold while asking another employee to verify your identity. Fake a smile. Tell him you understand the bank's policies. The man checking the IDs at the front door of the bar wasn't gay, and he laughed when Matt called him a breeder. He took pleasure in drawing large black permanent X's across the tops of your hands. This signaled to everyone that you weren't legally allowed to drink. In the morning, the X's would be impossible to wash from your skin, a permanent reminder of the night before. During the morning sales meeting, make few comments or suggestions. The manager reiterates the focus of the week. Write business checking accounts in bold letters next to where you've written no class tonight in your planner. Pretend to listen as the manager suggests ways for you to get customers to open business checking accounts. He asks you for the daily phone tag on. Say something simple. Thank you for calling Comerica, where we can help your business grow. The manager loves it. Smile when he says it's much better than the one they used yesterday. He goes to MSU, the other tellers whisper. He's going to get a real job. The manager asks you what you are studying. Ignore their confused looks when you say you want to be a writer. Fake a smile when the manager tells you that you might be better off working as a bank teller full time. Correct him when he says your mother has done it successfully for 20 years. It's been 30. Once inside, the bar pulsed and throbbed with a techno beat. You decided that gay men are somehow powered through flashing lights and disco balls. It's very similar to solar power. A drag queen known as Delicious burned your arm with her cigarette as Matt dragged you onto the dance floor. Surrounded by steel bars and a man-sized cage, you proceeded to gyrate, winning only the attention of men whose ages ranged from your father's and up. At work, your first customer complains when you ID him for attempting to cash a check. Remain composed as he tells you he's been banking here for 100 years. He doesn't care about policy, that you're only doing your job, that you fill in from branch to branch whenever someone has a day off, and so that's why you don't recognize him, that you're only a part-time employee because you're a full-time student and your parents never once considered that you might want to attend college after high school, so now you must support your own education since your parents certainly aren't going to. He just wants his cash. smile and tell him to have a nice day as he walks out the revolving front door, cursing under his breath. Later, pretend not to hear a customer, ask another teller if you're old enough to work at the bank, and understand when they don't allow you to wait on them because they think you are a new employee. They don't care that you've had this job for 2 years or how it makes you feel when others question your ability. Maybe you don't want to wait on them anyway. Listen to the other tellers successfully close referrals by getting customers to open new accounts. Comment on how nice it will be when the incentive money comes in their paycheck. Say, everyone can use a little cash around the holidays. You used the woman's bathroom because it was common knowledge that anyone who used the men was looking for sex, drugs, or both. You made Matt stand in front of the velvet curtain that served as a stall door, and he asked you what you thought of the guy he was dancing with. He looks older, you said, and Matt laughed. I know, right? He replied. While in mid-zip, a lesbian slid back the curtain. Matt must have left his post for the dance floor when the techno version of Britney Spears' My Prerogative started to play. She pinched your cheek and grabbed your ass as you exchanged positions within the stall. Escape to the bathroom for solace after a customer calls you ma'am over the phone. When the manager comes in and stands at the urinal next to you, respond to his questions with one-word answers. Try not to think about your shy bladder or how you can't pee with someone else in the room. Continue to stand there as he asks you questions about life. Decide that your manager has set a new world record for longest urination. He slaps your back and says something along the lines of, go get him, before leaving the bathroom without washing his hands. Wonder, who is he suggesting you go get? Customers? A new roommate? A new family? Who? By 2 a.m., you turn down 3 invitations to go back to someone's place and hang out. You gave up on the dance floor after being burned by 2 more smoking drag queens. You decided the burns would make you look tough. You bought a hot dog from Rebecca, the 56-year-old mysterious woman who sold various grilled wieners in the corner of the bar. You talked about her life as a late-night meat vendor and felt comfortable in her presence. You two had a lot in common. After all, she didn't want to be at the bar at 2 in the morning either, and you both liked wieners. Perhaps you were soulmates. At lunch, leave the branch while your coworkers eat in the break room and talk about their husbands, wives, and children. Tell yourself it's completely acceptable to have conversations with the sauce packets at Taco Bell. One reads, the feeling is mutual. Agree with the packet. You two have a lot in common. Perhaps you are soulmates. Sometime around 3 a.m., Matt got kicked out of the bar. An older gentleman bought him a drink and he was caught with it in the bathroom. Matt's friends told you he was outside waiting. On the way back to your apartment, Matt hung his head outside the window and managed to prevent himself from puking in the car. His friends thought it was hilarious. There's the Matt we know and love, they said, while you sat trying not to worry about how much he actually consumed in the last 6 hours. When it's time to close, balance your window to the penny. It's not hard to keep track of the money coming in and out of your drawer when customers don't allow you to wait on them. As the other tellers ask for assistance in finding their shortages, ask the manager if you can leave. You have a long drive home tonight, you tell him, and he says he understands. Don't acknowledge him when he promises to remember you next time. Hope he doesn't, and that by some miracle when you arrive home, your parents inform you that they have come into some money and you no longer have to work to pay for your college. Walk 2 blocks back to the parking garage and get in your car. Imagine yourself being a bank teller for the rest of your life. Drive. When you arrived home from the bar, Matt's friends left you to carry him back into your apartment. You thought about leaving him in the snow to teach him a lesson, but instead dragged his dead weight into the apartment and into his bedroom. He wouldn't remember this the following morning when he woke up, and you'd never receive a thank you. He would just sleep for the next 12 hours while you got up at 7 a.m. and went to work. The bar is located 2 blocks south of the bank, and you pass it on the way to your highway. Note how it looks before people arrive, before the flashing lights and techno music are turned on, and before men begin stumbling in and out the front door, coming and going to hang out. The traffic on the highway is heavy as expected. Cars honk their horns and gesture obscenities to one another through lightly frosted windows while frozen turkeys and pies sit in the back seat, waiting for whatever tomorrow may bring. For 15 minutes, follow a car in the slow lane that has their blinker signaling a right turn. Decide that this says a lot about your life and where you are going. After 2 hours, pull into your driveway. Hesitate before going inside. Think to yourself, tomorrow is Thursday, Thanksgiving, another day.